read a story that Tom Wright told. He said, when Moses was coming down the mountain after receiving the commandments from God, and he came to the people of Israel, he said, well, I've got good news and bad news. He said, the good news is I talked God down from 40 down to 10. Bad news is adultery is still in. Yeah, bad joke, but anyways. I always wonder how to start a sermon on a topic like lust. And so we're talking today about lust, not because I want you to lust, but because we want to talk about this in the topic of the seven deadly sins. And so we're finishing up the series for today, looking at the seven deadly sins, or sometimes referred to as the seven capital vices. And the idea behind the seven deadly sins that these early followers of Jesus around 300-400 years after Jesus started recognizing patterns in way of living. That the call of Jesus' followers was to be a different kind of people, to live lives modeled after Jesus. But as many of us have discovered as followers of Jesus, that we often fall into wrong patterns, wrong ways of living, that we don't live the way we desire. And so these early followers recognize what they call the seven deadly sins or seven capital vices as kind of habits or patterns that people tend to fall into. And they recognize them and said that out of these that many of the other sins that we do grow. And so they're kind of, that's what the idea behind capital is, that they're root. But they're these patterns, these ways of living, kind of like a groove that wears into something. And after a while, you kind of stay in that groove, you stay in that rut, and it's hard to get out of that. And so these seven deadly sins, things like envy. And envy is this desire, not just for what the other person has, but so much that you don't want the other person to have it. Or greed, which is this desire for possessions or simply possessing things. And how these can then subsequently lead to other things. So if you want other things, that could lead to theft, it could lead to murder, or anger, which was one of the things we talked about, wrath, and the way that unchecked anger and how that can rule us and how we can begin to then speak unkindly to people, and that can actually even lead to physical violence and even to murder. And so these patterns that set into people, and so we've been talking about those and what that looks like. And so today we conclude that series and look at this sin of lust and broadly of sexual sins, but we want to focus on lust. And there's sometimes some wrong paths or wrong different ways we look at that. And sometimes, depending on your background, where you come from, church can come off as all sexual desire is bad, or at least maybe sometimes what you hear in church is like, sex is bad, stay away from it until marriage, and then it's all good. And that's sometimes the way that it's framed, the conversation is framed, or maybe the only thing the church has to say about sex is it's bad, or no, don't do it. And so growing up, and it's kind of this culture that when I was a bit younger, and maybe even some of you who are a little bit younger than I am, remember this purity culture, and there was the idea of these purity rings. And I'm not saying the purity ring idea was bad, but the idea behind the purity ring was to stay pure. But the thing with the purity ring, it focused exclusively on our outside actions. And what Jesus gets at here in his message is that purity, as Jesus desires, isn't simply controlling the things we do, but it's a matter of the heart and dealing with that. And the other thing that I've noticed that has happened over the years is that in church that sometimes, and this is particularly true for men, is that sometimes our spirituality is reduced to our sexuality. And what I mean by that is this. That over the years, as I was involved in accountability groups for men, that sometimes what would happen is I'd be sitting with a group of men and somebody would say, how are you doing with Jesus? And the group, the exclusive conversation or the conversation would revolve almost exclusively around how they'd been doing sexually, whether they'd been looking at pornography, whether they'd been lusting, all these things. And so sometimes it was, and even I looked up Promise Keepers, which was a big thing back and I think is making a little bit of a comeback. They're starting a new thing, but they had these seven promises, and it was interesting because one of those promises involved spiritual, ethical, moral, and sexual purity. And I thought, it's kind of interesting, like sexual, why does that, doesn't that fall under ethical or moral? And I think part of what it is because it's highlighted as this thing that's bigger. And so sometimes, if you're talking to someone who's not part of church, or if you're talking to friends, or even if part of church is, sometimes people say, well, why is the church so hung up on this sex stuff? Why are you always talking about, why do you focus on this? There's all these other sins, but you get so caught up on this one thing. On the other hand, sometimes we can take the wrong turn that I think culture sometimes takes, is to say that all sexual activity is good as long as everybody agrees that it's good and as long as no one gets hurt. And so those are the kind of the different ends. And so today we're going to look at what Jesus has to say about this and what Paul has to say about this. And I want to recognize that all of you are coming from different places. And I know most of you sitting here, but I don't know every one of you where you are in your walk with Jesus. I don't know where you're at in a lot of different things. But one, I want to say, when Jesus is talking here, and this is important for us to recognize, that in Matthew chapter 5, that passage that was read when Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said," who is Jesus talking to at this point? His followers. He's talking to people who are wanting to learn and to follow him. Jesus isn't looking at the people on the outside. Jesus is talking to the people who follow him. And when Paul writes his letters and talks to them, he's writing to a group of church people. And I think this is important because sometimes in church, we look and we read and we read our Bible and we listen to what God has to say and we say, this is God's design, this is God's plan for sexuality. And then we start to broadcast that and to impose it on others. But the first step in that is not that. Jesus' first desire is not for us to make people sexually. Jesus' first desire is for them to become his followers, to know him, to be forgiven by him, and then out of that, to be changed and to be transformed. And so if you're sitting here today and you're not a follower of Jesus, I just want you to listen in on this conversation. Because this conversation, these words are directed at people who have committed themselves to following Jesus. So where do we begin a conversation on sexuality? Well, we begin a conversation on sexuality, and almost every theological conversation, I believe, begins on the first couple pages of the Bible. Chapters 1 and 2 of what we call the book of Genesis. And it's this story of creation, and it tells who God is and the nature of God's creation and what he created us to be and his purpose behind all that. And when God creates, he creates man and he creates woman. He speaks about it's not good for man to be alone, that there's something and that they're meant to be together. And then when Adam, the first man, sees the first woman, Eve, he says, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And then the writer goes on to say, and for this reason, a man shall leave his woman and cleave to the woman. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to the woman, and they shall become one flesh. And so there's this beginning picture of what God's design and plan for sexuality is. That it's designed to be between one man, one woman within the context of marriage. That's God's design for marriage. And the other thing is, it's a good thing. I mean, I think sometimes, again, in church, sometimes we get this idea like, sex is a bad thing, you know, you shouldn't even enjoy it. But God says it's a good thing. In fact, did you know there's an entire book of the Bible written exactly about this topic? Song of Songs, right? How many of you have read Song of Songs recently? Okay, I mean, it's got some strange imagery. It talks about, you know, your wife being like, you know, a goat running up a mountain. And I mean, it's seriously, go read it. I mean, it's strange imagery. But what the Song of Songs is essentially erotic poetry. It's a love song between a man and a woman, primarily from the woman directed to the man. It's talking about this beauty, and God includes this and says it because he wants people to understand that sexuality is a good thing and desire is a good thing when set within the right context. And that's why we need to begin from that place. So we want to avoid the idea that it's all bad. On the other hand, we have to take it seriously. We can't just say, well, it's good, so it's a free-for-all. Listen to what Jesus says is, he says, I tell you that, he says, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out. If your right hand causes you, cut it off. In other words, what he's saying is, dealing with sexual sin is something we need to take seriously. This is not something lighthearted. He's saying, it's better to do this. It's better to go maimed through life than to fall into this. And so he's talking about it. So what we need to do is realize that there is a reason to get upset and that it's a serious thing. And Rebecca DeYoung, whose book has been very helpful to me in doing this sermon series. Rebecca DeYoung wrote a book called Glittering Vices, and she talks about this. And one of the things she recognizes that sex is designed to bond two people into one flesh, and that we saw in the 1 Corinthians passage there, that's the purpose of sexuality, designed to bond people into one flesh. It's also designed for something else. Babies, right? I mean, that's babies. And so that was the early, again, back to the book of Genesis. Be fruitful and multiply. So sexuality is designed for what? Two things, to bond two people together emotionally, psychologically, and it's fascinating to read. Science is learning more and more about this, that there are chemicals released in the brain when two people engage in sexual activity, that there is a bonding that takes place at a deep physiological, psychological, emotional level. And so there's this bonding, this idea of one flesh, but it also has a procreative purpose to produce babies, which is a look to the future. So sex is designed for two things. It's designed for love, and it's designed for life. And so if sex is about love and life, and so this is what Rebecca DeYoung says. She says this: if lust has the power to damage human love-giving and life-giving, then perhaps we cannot make too big a deal of the destructive potential of sexual sin. She says, if lust has the power to damage human love-giving and life-giving, then perhaps we cannot make too big of a deal of the destructive potential of sexual sin. And so she's saying, yes, it's good. God is saying, yes, it's good, but it also has severe destructive power, and this is why. And so we begin with this idea of why it's a good thing, because each of the vices, these seven vices that we've studied, wrath and gluttony and stuff, takes something that is fundamentally good, a fundamentally good desire, and it becomes disordered. So vainglory, which was this desire for, he said, there's something fundamentally good about wanting appreciation, about desiring the affection and love of other people. That's a normal part of being a human being. But when we become obsessed with that, when we begin to manipulate that so that people are applauding us and looking to us, that's when it's become disordered. So last week we talked about gluttony, which was this desire for food. God designed us to desire and to want food and to enjoy good foods. We even looked at a passage where God speaks and talks about his image of the end times and creating this banquet and these pictures of these tables laid out with the choicest of foods and the best of wines. And so God has created in us a desire and a natural desire for good foods and enjoyment of those. But gluttony takes those and twists them and turns them. In the same way, lust takes a good and natural desire that God has given to us, and it twists and it turns and it distorts it. It takes something that's supposed to be love-giving and life-giving and pretends it's a party for one. And that's essentially what lust is. Lust takes these things, and if we think about sexual desire as something designed for love and for life, for doing these two things. In other words, it's other-focused. But lust turns it back on itself. And what happens is, in the case of lust, is sexual pleasure is divorced from love and mutual self-giving. We don't want to have to do with life and commitments. Lust degrades the fullness of sex into merely a physical act. Like I said, lust turns it into a party of one. And that's where it becomes a disordered desire, where that's essentially what lust is saying. It's purely about getting the physical pleasure. It becomes something focused entirely on myself. And so Jesus talks about this, and he says, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And so the idea of looking lustfully is not about the length of the look. Sometimes you think, well, if it's more than just, if it's only a 2-second look, it wasn't a lustful look. What Jesus is talking about is, what is the intent? What's going on in your mind? What's going on behind that look? Why are you looking? And this isn't just men. Sometimes we reduce this to just a man thing. It's a woman thing too. And so it's this desire when you're looking and you're watching and you're looking at someone, and what begins to go on in your heart. It's the intention. It's the fantasizing about the other. And that's why it's a vice, because it does not honor the fullness of sex. it alienates people from one another. If sex is designed to bond people together and it becomes purely a fantasy, if it becomes purely something about your own pleasure, then it alienates those two. If it becomes purely about self-gratification. So it can take many different forms. One of the most common forms, and it's a plague in the United States these days, is pornography. A multi-billion dollar industry. And I've seen various statistics and different things, and it's not entirely sure the way the studies on how many people and how much is viewed. But I would encourage you to look and to see some of the statistics about the average number of people, the number of views, the amount of hours of pornographic material that are put out on a daily basis, and how young people are exposed to pornography these days, and how easy it is, because when I was young, the only way to find pornography is maybe there were the magazines that were hidden behind the drugstore counter, or the other way was videos of the dark, the back room of the video stores and then the VHS tape. Do you know how easy it is to find pornography these days? It's right here in most everyone's pocket. And you don't even have to be looking for it in order to find it. You can be doing an innocent search, typing something in and say, oh, I was reading a story. One author was talking about a friend of his, and they in the town they live in, they have a sporting goods store, which is called Chick's Sporting Goods Store. Unfortunate name. So what happened was his son was trying to figure out something about Chick's, and so what did he do? He typed in the word Chick's on his search engine. You want to guess that probably it didn't just come up with sporting goods stuff. And so it can be found, it can be, and what happens, and again, there are studies being done, and I don't want to bore you with all the science of it, about the nature of pornography and how it can twist and the way in which what happens is that first image leads to the next image, which leads to the next image. And the way it works is then that those images can often become seared, scored, impressed on people's minds. So that someone who's looked at pornography, maybe even hasn't even looked at it for 20 or 30 years, those images are still there in their head. And the way that it distorts and it twists them and creates something different. And so, but I also want to notice that lust, sometimes we confine it simply to that. And so if lust is purely sexual activity for your own desire, I was thinking about this the other day, that means it is possible within a marriage to lust. Because if a man and a woman are in that one bond union, and they're your focus, one partner's focus is purely on their own gratification. If they're thinking solely about themselves in the context of this, I think that's lust. Because the sexual act is designed to be an act of mutual self-giving. And so sometimes we want to think, well, I don't have a problem. I don't look at pornography. Lust isn't a problem for me. Lust takes many different forms. And I'm not trying to say that all of you are guilty of lust. I mean, that's not my point. But to say that it has many different looks. And lust is a vice because it does not honor the fullness of that. And so if we strip off the fact that sex has a personal and a social meaning, and so that's what you see when you go through the grocery store line. And there are the magazines at the grocery store checkout, magazines like Maxim and Cosmopolitan and Men's Health and all these magazines. And I remember, again, telling many stories about when I was younger, which I was younger, was that when Men's Health magazine first came out, that's what Men's Health magazine, it was a health magazine. There were workout plans, there were food. And then I noticed this gradual shift over the years in Men's Health magazine, where it started looking more like the men's version of Cosmo. And if you're not familiar with Cosmo magazine, it's just, but all of a sudden it was like every art issue started coming with tips on how to have a better orgasm or better ways to, you know, pick up women. Wait a minute, I thought this was a health magazine. And it started talking about all these different things. But what had happened was that these magazines began to strip off and make sex and sexuality purely about what? The feeling. About the desire. And so if you walk through and you say, well, you know, 20 tips to become hotter in bed, 6 ways to the best orgasm ever. These are the kind of things it's talking about. And so those are what? Completely divorced from, completely separated from what God designed and intended sexual expression to be. He designed it as a way to bond two people together. He designed it as a way to produce children. And it becomes something separately. And so these magazines have nothing to say about what it looks like in the context of love. And in fact, it's interesting, even the language we use. And so the old language is sexual intercourse. And I remember even as a middle school student and reading, I don't remember even what the book was, reading this book, and it talked about two people having intercourse. And it just meant they were having a conversation. I mean, that was literally, it was a conversation, because intercourse is just this dialogue. And of course, you know, what's an eighth grade boy? Look, they're having intercourse. But no, the fact that sexual intercourse, think about it, sexual intercourse is the design. In other words, there's a conversation, there's a mutuality. And now we've reduced sexual intercourse to just sex. And there's no longer mutuality, there's no longer conversation between the two. And so, in some ways, we're going to take a jump back, and I know all of you weren't here last week, gluttony, there's a strong relationship between gluttony and lust, because gluttony was seeing food only as a means to fill ourselves, and lust sees sex only as its usefulness in giving pleasure to the self. And why is that so bad? You might think, well, who's hurt? I mean, if I sit and I sit with a magazine and lust after someone, who is hurt by that? One, we are. You yourself are, because I'm beginning to warp and I'm beginning to change. Because Jesus gave a fundamental picture of what life in the kingdom of God looks like as he talked to his followers. He said, there are two commands. One command, he said, which has two parts. One is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. The other is what? To love your neighbor as yourself. In the act of lust, what am I doing? My neighbor is not being loved. The neighbor is what? Becoming simply a means to my own gratification. And so that's exactly what is happening here. Is we've changed this, because love requires real people and real exchange. And the other is we're seeking fulfillment in something which will not satisfy. And again, to go back to some of the science and stuff, is there are studies being done on people who watch pornography and engage in those things. And what scientists and sociologists are discovering is that as people begin watching it, they require more and more explicit, more and more violent, more and more, in order for it to produce arousal. And so what happens is, because it's an empty sham, because it doesn't involve another person, it increases. And so what they find is people who are content to watch something, all of a sudden it's not just enough, that they've got to have something that's even more explicit, something that maybe even contains more violence, something that's even more bizarre. And so it's this thing, and it begins to distort and twist the soul within it. And one writer I was reading talked about the paradox of pleasure. And so here's the problem with lust, is it's a quest for pleasure. The thing about pleasure is, you never find pleasure by going to look for pleasure. You find pleasure by doing things that bring you pleasure. So you go and you read about, I mean, you don't go to the beach just like, I want to enjoy my, you go, and in the experience of that thing, you find the pleasure. And this is kind of the way the ancient Greeks spoke about it. But Aristotle spoke of pleasure as a fruit of an activity, not something produced apart from the activity. We recognize that everything has pleasure. But he's saying that pleasure is the fruit, but when we go looking for it, we don't find it. And so likewise, sexual pleasure comes from the activity from which you get it. The lustful person gets the sham, shallow version. In marriage, pleasure is the fruit of love. And the other thing is, we say, what's the damage? The damage is that we are connected mind, soul, and body. We're not a separate physical and spiritual being. And so we recognize this reality of the way we are connected. And we recognize it in all kinds of different ways. If you are physically tired, does that affect you emotionally? Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And in the same way, you can flip it around. It says, when we enjoy a good meal, or when we exercise, does that and then affect us emotionally and spiritually? It does. So our bodies, our souls, our spirits are tied. And so we can't separate those two things. And so when we think about these sexual, this lust, this is why it's so destructive, because it's not something that just goes in inside, because what's inside affects us. And Jesus here, or Paul talks about even the fact that we're uniting when we're bonding with someone else. Our bodies are temples of the Spirit, and how this all affects. And so there's this complicated thing. And so we need to realize that it's not something that simply doesn't do damage. And you know, we might think, oh, well, I don't notice any damage. But it's like a lot of things. You know, if you have a leak in your house and it's dripping behind the wall, you might not notice the damage right now. You might not notice the damage a week from now or even a year from now. But eventually it will rot. In the same way lust does that same thing, we might think, oh, there's no harm being done. But there's harm being done to your own soul and to your own love, because you're not living out the life that God has called us to love others. And we've turned others simply into a means for our own pleasure. So how do we remedy this? How do we deal with this? Because I don't want to leave you in this place of saying, oh, wow, lust is a big problem. What do I do now? What do we do with it? One is we recognize it's hard work. Go back to these words of Jesus. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. So do you think Jesus is literally suggesting cutting off body parts and gouging them out? No. Because if he were, do you think he picked the right body parts? I mean, no, serious, but sorry. But I mean, if this is what he's not dealing with just body parts. He's saying that we need to take this seriously. And this is the kind of hard work. And there were some early followers who believed it. Because the truth of what Jesus is saying is, even if you gouged out your eyes, would that take care of the problem of lust? There were people in some parts of the world who thought the best way to avoid it was like, well, I'm never going to look at a woman. And so they would just like, they would cloister themselves off and say, it doesn't solve the problem. One is, then what does that turn? I mean, then you never engage in relationships and you destroy yourself. And so it's not a matter of doing that. And I want you to pay attention. I'm going to, a little tangent here is, note what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, if you're suffering from lust, tell the girl over there to put on better clothes. This is a peeve of mine. It bugs me sometimes, because sometimes what we turn lust, the lust problem of men, sometimes into a problem with women. And it's not a woman problem. This is, okay, where do we always go back to good theology? Genesis 1 and 2 and chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3, Adam gets busted by God. And what does Adam say? It's the woman you gave me. Don't play the Adam card, guys. If you have a problem with lust, it's not the girl's fault. It's a problem inside your own heart. Now, there we can have conversations about modesty and dress. That's a separate conversation. But I want us to be absolutely clear that lust is a problem within our own heart. It's not somebody else's fault. And so we have to do the hard work of dealing with what's going on inside our mind. Do the hard work of establishing healthy habits and a healthy view of people. And so it's a matter of the heart and the mind. And so lust, and so what are the ways we deal with it? One is to recognize that lust thrives where? In isolation, in loneliness. And so one of the best ways to deal with it is in community. It's having groups of people, of being open and accountable with people. I know I talked about the accountability groups and how those sometimes get caught in that, but that is one of the best ways to do it, is to have accountability groups. And accountability groups aren't simply the group where you come and you say, well, how was your week? Well, I looked at some porn this week. Bad boy. And you get slapped. And then you come back the next week and they say, well, how did you do? Well, I looked at some porn. And that's not an accountability group. That's just a guilt group. An accountability group is then somebody says, well, I looked, and they say, well, okay, how can I help you? That's the mutuality, is the recognition. And so it's recognizing that we need openness. We need to be able to have these conversations. And that's why it's important to even have a conversation on a Sunday morning, is to recognize that, again, statistics vary. And I was reading a review of a book the other day, And this review was suggesting that sometimes the statistics get a little bit exaggerated about pornography and things within the church. But even looking on the, I guess, best side of it, from what I could tell from reading these statistics, was that for regular churchgoers, that approximately 35%, and I don't remember if this was all or just men, had used pornography sometime in the past 6 months. 35%, one in three. So that means it's a problem. Even, like I said, sometimes they're saying, some of the statistics will say, well, there's really not much difference between Christians and the rest of the world. And this study said, well, it depends on how you label it. It said, but for regular churchgoers, there is a significant difference between regular churchgoers and the rest of the world. And I thought, oh, that's really good. And then I looked at the chart and said it was still at 35%. So we may be better than a lot of others. We may not be at 70%, but 35% is still a whole lot of problem. 35% is still a whole lot of people who have a misshapen, distorted view of sexuality, who are seeing other people merely as a means of fulfillment to themselves, who are distorting a gift that God has given to us. And so we need to find a way to be open and accountable. And that means creating a community of grace where we can find that person we can go talk to and say, I'm having troubles. And know that they're not going to look at us with an eye of condescension, to know that they're not going to look down on us, to know that they're not going to put us down, but to simply say to us, I am here for you. How can I help you? We can also recognize what makes us vulnerable. What makes us vulnerable to lust? Sometimes it's, for a lot of people, it's just being tired. I know for me, when I'm tired, I do a lot of things that I wouldn't do in many other situations. I get angry a lot more easily. My thoughts go places they shouldn't go. And so tiredness can be one of the ways. We can recognize that being alone can do that. We can watch our language and be respectful. You know, we can be watchful and wary of what we're consuming on television, the movies, and thinking about the messages that's portrayed. And Paul, in one other place, he says, think out of what is good and pure and right. And so we can begin to fill our minds with what is good and pure. And so we can begin to monitor and do those things. And then what we want to do is form an accurate picture of what love looks like in terms of good, of giving and receiving. In other words, one of the best ways to avoid the bad isn't to focus on avoiding the bad, but to focus on being, improving the good. To begin to develop a healthier relationship, to think about other people and to see what it looks like to truly love other people. And to love other people means to seek their best. And so as we begin to shape and form the good, rather than saying, oh, I'm going to avoid the bad, because that's the nature of things. When you say, oh, don't do that, where does your mind instantly go? It goes to the other place. And I learned something in driving, too, is if you're swerving in a car and there's a tree, you don't want to look at the tree, because that's a tendency. Well, I'm going to avoid the tree. You want to look where you want to go, because if you look at the tree, you know where you're going to end up? In the tree. And it's the same way with a lot of our spiritual life. We don't want to focus on like, oh, that's the bad stuff, and so I'm going to keep my... We want to focus on what's good and what's pure. And so we keep our minds in those places. And so Jesus is calling us to this higher ethic. He's calling us to this different place. And so as we get ready and we celebrate communion together, we recognize that we are all fallen and broken people. And this is the message that even in the context of hearing this, and we say lust is this thing and here's this better, is to say we are all fallen and broken people. But the communion table reminds us that in the midst of our fallenness, in the midst of our brokenness, that God enters into the world. That Jesus enters into the world and dies on a cross. And when we break bread and drink a cup and we say, this is my body broken for you, and we speak about Jesus' body being broken, that he died to forgive us of our sins. But not only that, then we take that in. We take in the bread and we take in the cup. And through that, it's a physical symbol of us taking in the power of God, of taking in the power of the Spirit to live a clean and a pure and a healthy life, to live this kind of life. And so Jesus paints this contrast in the Sermon on the Mount, which this passage was taken from, to saying, here's this high, incredible ethic, realizing we're never going to live up to it. But at the same time, it's this ethic filled with grace and says, you are welcome. And so we come to this table and we remind ourselves that we are all in desperate need of God's grace. We are all fallen and we are all broken. But then as we take in, we say, God still comes to us in the midst of the brokenness. And then he invites us to live this new life and he gives us the strength to do that through the power of his Spirit. So lust is something that distorts our God-given gift of sexuality. It distorts our love for neighbor as our neighbors become something purely for our own pleasure. And God desires for that love within us to be changed and to be transformed. And that happens through Jesus' death and resurrection and through the power of the Holy Spirit. And so, if that's a struggle for you, know, first of all, that you're not struggling alone. Find someone to talk to. Come talk to me. And, you know, if you don't feel comfortable with me, come talk to someone if that's a struggle for you. And find mutual help in sharing together. But also know that Jesus still loves you. That you're not beyond redemption. That this isn't some sin where like, oh, well, that's your problem. We're kicking you out of here. No, we've all got our problems. We all have our hang-ups. We're all broken people. And that's why we're here. Because in the midst of our brokenness, we are deeply loved by Jesus. But you've heard me say it before. Jesus invites us to come as we are, but he doesn't want us to stay that way. He longs to change and to transform us. And so may, even as you come as you are and bring yourself, and we're going to sing the song, say, come to the table just as you are, come as you are, but realize that Jesus and his power and his love will change and transform you.